We'll see you again.
Help CFRC serve our community listeners. Have your voice heard and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smokes Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support. Good afternoon, everyone. It is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. You are listening to Campus Beat. I'm Dinah Jansen. In this program, the CFRC news team welcomes new guests from the Queen's University community and covers news, issues, upcoming and recent events, initiatives, and services for the benefit of Queen's University students, faculty, staff, and alumni. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to Campus Beat. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me today is CFRC's campus news reporter, Ali El-Safadi. In this week's top campus news stories, Queen's University remembers the Honorable Murray Sinclair, Chancellor Emeritus and Special Advisor to the Principal on Reconciliation, who passed away on Monday, November 4th in Winnipeg following a period of illness. He was 73. His honor served as Queen's 15th Chancellor from 2021 to 2024 and was the first Indigenous person to serve in the role. He brought many years of leadership experience in governance and law, most notably through his service as the Justice to the Court of Queen's Bench in Manitoba, his role as Chief Commissioner of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and a senator in the Senate of Canada. In recent years, he served as General Counsel with Cochrane Saxberg LLP, Manitoba's largest Indigenous law firm. He has received honorary doctorates from 14 universities, including Queen's University, in 2019. As one of Canada's most significant advocates for Indigenous people, his unwavering commitment to the principles of equity and inclusion transformed the country's political landscape for the better. Similarly, while at Queen's, his expertise and care significantly contributed to the university's ongoing evolution as an institution, according to the university's official statement. During his time as Chancellor, Sinclair played a pivotal role in advancing truth and reconciliation, decolonization, and Indigenization on campus. He helped facilitate critical advances on reviewing university practices, policies, and procedures, and he lent his keen and thoughtful wisdom to priority initiatives such as the university's National Day for Truth and Reconciliation activities. Queen's was uniquely honored when Chancellor Sinclair agreed to take on the position, and we have benefited enormously from his wisdom and commitment. He understood the key role institutions like ours can and must play in the process of reconciliation, said Principal and Vice Chancellor Patrick Dean. We will miss him for that, as well as his wonderful personal warmth and good humor. He was a great man, fiercely principled, yet profoundly humane. After his honor opted not to seek reappointment for a second term as Queen's University Chancellor, he instead transitioned to Special Advisor to the Principal on Reconciliation. Award-winning broadcast journalist Sheila Rogers was chosen to succeed Sinclair and began her term in July 2024. She is his cousin and close friend. We have lost a visionary leader who acted out of wisdom, his deep humanity, and love. Chancellor Emeritus Sinclair gave us the opportunity to learn the truth and, as importantly, to unlearn the foundational myths at the heart of the history of Canada, said Chancellor Rogers. He calls us still to change the world and to make it better for each new generation, aligning with the raison d'être of our university. The best way to honor him is to continue his essential work, she said. A sacred fire has been lit in his honor on the grounds of the Manitoba Legislative Building, and in lieu of flowers, the family is asking those who are able to donate to the Murray Sinclair Memorial Fund at the Winnipeg Foundation. In other top headline news, award-winning broadcast journalist Sheila Rogers, Queen's University's 16th Chancellor, was officially installed at the first Fall 2024 convocation ceremony on November 11th. Principal and Vice Chancellor Patrick Dean announced her appointment in April 2024 following confirmation by University Council. Her incredible career, wide-ranging experience, and passion for mental health, truth, healing, and reconciliation make her an ideal representative for Queen's and its values. We are very fortunate to have her serve as our university's highest officer and ceremonial head, said Principal Dean in a statement. Chancellor Rogers began her career in broadcast journalism at CFRC 101.9 FM, the campus radio station, while studying at Queen's until 1977. Later, she spent 40 years as a CBC broadcaster, working on notable programs like Morningside, The Arts Tonight, This Morning, and The Next Chapter. She went on to be recognized with the John Drainey Award for her significant contributions to Canadian broadcasting. Beyond her career, Rogers is an advocate for mental health, earning accolades from the Center for Addiction and Mental Health and the inaugural Margaret Trudeau Award for Mental Health Advocacy. Named an Officer of the Order of Canada in 2011, she is also dedicated to amplifying Indigenous voices, co-editing book series Speaking My Truth and serving as an honorary witness to the testimonies of residential school survivors and their families during the national gatherings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. Chancellor Rogers was installed during the first ceremony of the Fall 2024 convocation on November 11th, allowing her to preside over the following ceremonies and to confer degrees, key parts of a chancellor's official duties. CFRC was on hand to live broadcast the installation ceremony at Grant Hall and the private reception held at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. To listen to the official installation and reception, visit CFRC's Campus Beat podcast via podcast.cfrc.ca and available on Spotify and Apple Music. In other campus news, the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, otherwise known as NSERC, has recognized two Queen's University researchers for their career and lifetime achievements in environmental science. Dr. Carrie Rowe of Civil Engineering and Dr. John Small of Biology have each earned major NSERC awards acknowledging the national and global impact of their work and underscoring the university's leadership in environmental research. Dr. Rowe, an internationally renowned expert in geo-environmental engineering, including landfill design and contaminant migration, has received the prestigious Girard Ertzberg Canada Gold Medal for Science and Engineering, awarded annually to a Canadian whose research achievements have demonstrated persistent excellence and influence in the natural sciences or engineering. The Ertzberg Medal is widely considered to be Canada's highest honor for research in these fields. Dr. Small, considered the top researcher in his field, has played a key role in shaping evidence-based environmental conservation policies and has been awarded the Donna Strickland Prize for Societal Impact of Natural Sciences and Engineering Research. The annual award is given to a team or individual whose research has significantly benefited society, the environment, or the economy. The NSERC Awards recognize the dedication and excellence of Drs. Rowe and Small and the Queen's research community, said Nancy Ross, Vice Principal of Research at Queen's University. We are proud to support their work, which inspires a better, more sustainable future for all, and congratulate them on these incredible honors. Dr. Rowe and Dr. Small were recognized at a ceremony in Ottawa. For more information on these prizes, visit the NSERC website. And still further in campus news, Queen's University also conferred its annual Distinguished Service Awards in October at a reception held at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. Inaugurated by the University Council in 1974, the Distinguished Service Award recognizes individuals who have made the university a better place through their extraordinary contributions. The 2024 Distinguished Service Award recipients were Monica Corbett, Director of Admissions and Student Services for the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, Wilma P. Hopman, an adjunct professor in the Department of Public Health Sciences, Dr. Stephen C. Lockheed, director of the Queen's University Biological Station, Dr. Sue Moffat, associate professor of medicine, Stephanie Simpson, the inaugural vice principal of culture, equity, and inclusion at Queen's University, and Mary Wilson Trider, alumna volunteer who served as chair of the Board of Trustees. Learn more about the awards, the recipients, and watch video of the awards reception via queensu.ca/secretariat. That's it for me, and now over to Ali Al-Safadi with more in Queen's University Campus News.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Campus Beat. This is Ali Safadi, CFRC's Campus News reporter, and today we have a very powerful topic that not only touches on international politics, but resonates here on campus. In today's segment, we'll discuss the work of Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories. Recently, she's been navigating complex political waters, including some intense backlash here in Canada, as she advocates for human rights in occupied Palestinian territories. We'll break down the challenges she faces, including a special teach-in she delivered at Queen's University on November 7th. Francesca Albanese has been serving as a United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories since 2022. Her role, while embedded in humanitarian efforts, is anything but straightforward. As Special Rapporteur, Albanese is tasked with investigating and reporting on human rights conditions in the occupied Palestinian territories. Her work revolves around monitoring and documenting violations, as well as assessing the impact on the civilian population, and of course, to critically provide recommendations to the international community on actions they can take to protect Palestinian human rights. What's unique about this position is its independence. Albanese operates without interference, which allows her to deliver an unfiltered account of the realities on the ground. This independence, however, also means her findings can sometimes generate backlash, especially from governments or institutions implicated by her reports. And that is exactly what happened here in Canada. On her recent visit, Albanese was met with unexpected resistance. She held a press conference to highlight the situation in Palestine, but Canadian officials largely avoided meeting with her. Albanese described it as being snubbed, a move that left her questioning Canada's commitment to upholding human rights universally. Her experience here raised a lot of questions about the role of politics in humanitarian advocacy. Canada often promotes itself as a champion of human rights, so when a UN official's visit is largely ignored, it brings up issues of selectivity and accountability. Albanese's work emphasizes that human rights should transcend politics, and she remains firm in her commitment to report truthfully and fairly. But what does this work look like in practice? For Albanese, data collection involves gathering evidence directly from affected communities, such as listening to the experiences of civilians, as well as speaking with local NGOs and legal experts. She reviews cases of displacement, violence, and other forms of systemic oppression faced by Palestinians in these territories. Her reports aim to give a voice to those who are often unheard and provide a detailed account of their daily struggles under occupation. Each report she submits to the UN calls for concrete actions and highlights systemic issues like restricted movement, home demolitions, and lack of access to resources. She hopes to ignite international support for change. Her work is part legal, part investigative, and fully driven by commitment to justice. Albanese approaches her role with a sharp focus on the legal frameworks that apply to occupation and human rights. She's frequently in contact with international lawyers and human rights experts to ensure her reports are grounded in international law. In her recent statements, she has emphasized that these issues are not just political, they're legal and moral imperatives that require action. Francesca Albanese's critiques of Israeli policies have generated significant backlash, particularly in Canada and the United States. Before her recent visit to Canada, organizations such as UN Watch and Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs publicly called for her entry to be blocked, arguing that her statements went beyond criticizing Israeli policy, accusing her of anti-Semitism. These accusations are rooted in her comparisons of Israel's policies to those of oppressive regimes. One of the main points of contention is Albanese's view on the state of Israel and its treatment of Palestinians. In particular, she has made comparisons that critics argue and play into harmful historical stereotypes. Some of her statements have described Israel's actions as echoing those of colonial powers, drawing sharp rebukes from Israeli supporters. In the United States, the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, publicly declared that Albanese's stance made her unfit for her position. On the other hand, Canadian MP Anthony Housefather expressed confusion as to why the UN allows her to continue as Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian human rights given these controversial positions. For these critics, they say that Albanese's comments blur the lines between critique of Israeli policy and anti-Semitism, further questioning her neutrality in what is supposed to be an impartial human rights role. Yet, Albanese has consistently defended her position, clarifying that her criticisms are not aimed at the Jewish people or Judaism, but at specific Israeli state policies which she believes violate international law and Palestinian human rights. She stresses that Israel's actions in Palestine are not a reflection of the Jewish people as a whole, but rather the result of systemic policies that perpetuate occupation and oppression. Her work and views have placed her at the heart of a heated debate over what constitutes legitimate criticism of Israel and what crosses into anti-Semitism. She has become a polarizing figure, embraced by those who advocate for Palestinian rights, but vilified by others who believe her words harm the prospects of peace in the region. There has been a lot of controversy around Albanese and her statements. However, during her recent lecture at Queen's University, she offered a deeper look into her beliefs and the complicated history that shapes her views. Speaking with raw emotion, Albanese addressed the historical trauma experienced by Jewish people, particularly in relation to the Holocaust. She reminded the audience of the deep pain that Jewish communities have endured for centuries. As she put it, "We need to recognize that the Jewish people have faced discrimination for centuries." Albanese elaborated on the experiences of Holocaust survivors, many of whom fled Europe only to find their hopes of refuge dashed. She recalled that boats filled with Holocaust survivors, desperate for safety, were turned away by countries like Canada, leaving them with few options. Albanese's recognition of Jewish suffering speaks to her understanding of the complex history of occupied Palestine. She made it clear that she was not dismissing the pain of Jewish communities, but rather contextualizing the present in light of that shared history. While a colonial project emerged at that time, she said, "Nothing that happened 80 years ago justifies what is being imposed on Palestinians today." In her view, the Holocaust legacy and the trauma of the Jewish people have been exploited to justify the ongoing subjugation of Palestinians. She said, "The pain and trauma of Jewish people has been exploited and has become the soul of a political ideology." For Albanese, the lessons of history should be a call for justice, not a reason to perpetuate further injustice. Her message resonates deeply with those who see the continued occupation of Palestine as a violation of the very human rights that the Jewish people have long sought for themselves. Albanese's attempt to bridge the gap between these two painful histories is both an acknowledgement of shared human suffering and a call for accountability. By recognizing the historic trauma of the Jewish people, as well as understanding the struggles faced by Palestinians, she's attempting to articulate a vision for peace and justice that doesn't rely on the perpetuation of violence, occupation, or injustice. In her eyes, the need for recognition and human dignity is universal, whether for Palestinians or for Jewish people. This should guide international efforts for peace. Albanese emphasized that her role as a UN rapporteur isn't about taking sides. It's about presenting the facts as they are, guided solely by international law. As she put it, "What is the endgame here? They are depopulating Gaza." Her commitment to this work is fueled by a profound sense of justice and, as she describes, a rage that she's never felt before. In her latest report, Albanese zoomed out of Gaza, focusing more on the West Bank and how illegal settlers are attacking Palestinian civilians. For her, this isn't just an isolated issue, it's a part of an ongoing systemic reality. Her stance reflects the urgency she feels. She's adamant that the world cannot ignore the staggering number of people affected, from those killed to those facing acute famine. Her work has been controversial, and she's fully aware of the resistance she faces. She has still expressed a firm commitment to report the facts. In her view, to be silent or to downplay what's occurring would only compound the suffering of those affected. Her aim is not to incite, but to educate, and she often speaks of the need to bring a certain grace to these efforts despite the emotional toll. "We must be graceful if we want to be educators," she said, advocating for a thoughtful, empathetic approach to raising awareness. She also shared her conviction that educators and advocates should not carry the weight of this crisis alone, nor should they overload themselves emotionally. The work is intense, but it's also a collective responsibility. Francesca Albanese's message is clear. International law must prevail, and human rights cannot be dismissed in pursuit of political agendas. Her work as a UN rapporteur for the Palestinian territories represents a powerful call to the world to recognize both historical traumas and present-day realities in their full context. She's not a partisan advocate, but an unwavering voice for human dignity, pushing for a future where accountability replaces suffering and truth holds power over fear. Thank you for joining me today as we explored Francesca Albanese's crucial work and the complex realities she highlights in the Palestinian territories. This was Ali Safadi, CFRC's campus news reporter, and if you're interested in hearing more, be sure to check out my next segment where I'll be covering some interesting news stories on campus.
Thank you, Ali. And now we'll return to him in just a moment with coverage of the recent AMS trustees election and fall referenda.
Cold weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at Old Farm FF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Hey, Queen's students, did you know our campus is making a global impact? Queen's Hand Voice fights for North Korean human rights, and they have exciting news. 5 North Korean families have been recently resettled in Canada thanks to Hand Voice's incredible work. If you're passionate about human rights or making a difference, get involved with Queen's Hand Voice through awareness events, advocacy, and fundraising. Together with you, Queen's Hand Voice can amplify the voices of North Korean defectors and fight for freedom. Follow Queen's Hand Voice on Instagram. Go out to their events and be part of something truly impactful.
Hello, Queens. This is Ali Safadi, CFRC's campus news reporter, bringing you the latest on the results of the AMS Fall 2024 referendum. Let's dive into the numbers and see how students voted on some key campus issues and funding initiatives. First up, we've got the undergraduate trustee election results, and congratulations go out to EJ Kelvin, who will be taking on this important role for our campus community. Now on to student activity fees. Students voted on a mix of new fees, fee increases, and triennial reviews. Notably, the Queen's University Chapter of Women in Science and Engineering earned strong support, with a 50-cent fee passing by over a 70% approval vote. For the triennial reviews, several groups retained their funding for another 3 years. The Queen's Space Engineering Team, as well as Queen's Rocket Engineering Team, and the Queen's Backing Action on the Climate Crisis fees all passed. Likewise, Royal Bogaus Queens, Queen's University Blood Team, Sustainability Action Fund, and Friday Friends at Queen's have passed, and fees will all continue, signaling ongoing student support for sustainability and STEM initiatives. In a binding question, students overwhelmingly supported the AMS joining the Canadian Alliance for Student Associations, or CASA, as an observer, with over 84% voting yes. This move will strengthen student representation on national issues. CASA represents 365,000 students nationwide, advocating on issues like student loan interest removal, increased grants, and Indigenous representation. As an observer, Queens will gain federal advocacy access without a membership fee, opening doors to connect with other student unions and influence policies that impact students here at Queens. For more details on these results and how they'll shape our campus, visit myams.org. Thank you everyone for listening. This was Ali Safadi, CFRC's campus news reporter. Make sure to tune in, stay informed, and we'll see you next time.
And now over to Jesse Bell, CFRC's local journalism initiative producer, with more in Gale's sports action.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report for Monday, November 11th, 2024. It was a historic weekend for the Queens men's cross country team, who took home their first national championship since 1984. Jude Wheeler D was the top finisher of the day for the Gales, crossing the line 13th overall with a final time of 23 minutes and 49 seconds, and he was followed closely by his teammate Roman Miranov, who finished 14th with the same time. The Gales team of Jude Wheeler D, Roman Miranov, Will Cox, Tanner Hughlin, Angus Skinner, Peter Neal, and Miles Brackenberry finished with a combined 94 points. Head coach Mark Bomba would receive the U Sports Men's Cross Country Coach of the Year award for his team's national title finish. It was also an outstanding weekend for the Queens women's volleyball team, who hosted 2 games at the Arc Friday night and Saturday night. In both contests, they took on a top-tier Windsor Lancers team and swept them on Friday and Saturday. A consistent thread running through both games was the outstanding performance of Hannah Ducheneau and Claire Carter, who held up the majority of the Gales' offensive firepower. On defense, Amanda Sixna and Christine Abu played consequential roles, and in the Saturday night contest, it was a block from Abu that sealed the 3-0 sweep. The men's volleyball team also played 2 games over the weekend. They dropped the first to the Windsor Lancers by a score of 3-1, but they came out focused on Saturday night and took control early. It was the efforts of Zig Leachus, Chris Zimmerman, and Reed Venning that allowed the Gales to power past the undefeated Lancers by a score of 3-0. The men's and women's team will be hosting the Waterloo Warriors this weekend. The first game is 6 p.m. Friday. That'll be the women kicking things off, with the men following at 8 p.m. And then on Saturday, November 16th, the women will kick things off at 4 p.m. with the men following at 6. That's a wrap for today's sports report. This is Jesse Bell.
Thank you so much, Jesse, for that Gale Sports Report. We have a few events coming up around campus this week. You can join University Hospitals Kingston Foundation at the University Club on Wednesday, November 13th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. for Discovery Den, where KHSC physicians and staff pitch an innovative idea for a chance to receive up to $50,000 in grant funding to implement their hospital innovation ideas to help improve patient and family experiences. Refreshments are served and tickets are $10. You can also head over to the Grad Club on Wednesday night for Be Kind Rewind, a drag celebration of the 1990s featuring performances by some of your local favorite drag entertainers, as well as music videos. You can also show off your knowledge with 90s trivia, your footbag skills with some hacky sack, and all the fun starts at 8 p.m. at the Grad Club. Tickets are $12. The Grad Club is, of course, hosting its hugely popular trivia night on Thursday night starting at 8 p.m. for free. And also, the Grad Club is hosting a hypnotic bar experience on Friday night, a comedy show with hypnotist Albert Narenberg starting at 8 p.m. And on Saturday, folks can also explore the art of nature at the Moss Art Workshop at the Tet Center for Creativity and Learning from 9 to 12 p.m., led by Laura Moses. And that's a wrap for Campus Beat. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Help CFRC serve our community listeners. Have your voice heard and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smokes Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
On Saturday, November 30th, the Independent Wrestling Academy, in cooperation with CFRC 101.9 FM, presents IWA Wrestling School of Rock. A portion of the proceeds from this family-friendly professional wrestling event will be donated directly to CFRC's annual funding drive. Tickets are available for $20 and can be bought through iwacanada.ca. The event is scheduled to take place at the Upper Hall of the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. Doors at 5 p.m., opening bell will be at 5:30. Be sure to check out cfrc.ca and iwacanada.ca for additional event details. We hope to see you there, and we hope you're ready to rock the Spire.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this November at the Broom Factory, featuring some of your favorite big-name acts and a few local gems. On November 1st, check out Canadian indie legend Destroyer live at Broom Factory with Fortunato, Doretti, Marnetti. On November 8th, don't miss Shania Twink, your favorite all-queer femme country and pop cover band. On November 20th, Canadian rock and roll powerhouse JJ Wild comes back to town, and on November 25th, hip-hop icon Classified with support from Rhea May take the stage at the Broom. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com. See you at the shows.
Fern Point Broadcast, a 3-hour transmission art performance. Microphones, field recordings, tuned synthesizers, playback machines, and prepared compositions. Join us on November 16th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. I'll be your host, Slowman Tofu, with special guest contributions. Broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston and CFRC.ca.
Oh, waiter.
Yes, I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of hot?
Make sure it's hot.
Alphabet Soup is a musical variety show that's live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m.
Make sure it's hot.
Right.
Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, Table 26 wants a hot Alphabet Soup!
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. We're here with Sam, Kyle, and actually a third new guest that has not been on the show thus far, Charlie McKay.
Everyone.
So yeah, we got a big lineup of sports news today. Some pretty big fumbles in the NHL world as well as some other sports. We'll get started with the Nashville Predators. We've spoken about them a bit before. I've watched some of their games. Yeah, there's some weird stuff going on there. I know that Saros got a shutout the other night, so that's a bit more promising. But as I said before, yeah, it's kind of a weird scenario where you have one of the top goaltenders in the league, and he's not really pulling through. Some of your D's kind of just not meshing, and your forwards just can't seem to find that click, right? So Forsberg's still working pretty hard in the offensive zone, but a lot of his goals and offensive production have actually kind of been like individual efforts. So they haven't really produced on the power play. But, they got that win, so it's looking like they're starting to mesh a little bit better. But
I think for Nashville, the issue is really their chemistry. I think they just have too many new parts to their team. It's kind of hard when you bring in a superstar guy like Stamkos. I mean, let's consider this for a second. Stamkos is a first overall pick, a prodigy who came to Tampa Bay, and I would say he probably still is one of the best shooters in the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's up for debate a little bit just because of his age. He's been a little bit less active. But statistically, he's been at over a point a game, nonetheless. But anytime you have a new player like that who receives a lot of spotlight, it mixes up the dynamic. And I don't think Nashville's going to keep struggling for that long.
Yeah,
that's a rough spot to be in. 5-9-1 is not a good start to a season by any means.
No. It's an interesting spot, and I think it's actually a reflective of a larger kind of almost like sentiment and structure of teams in the U.S. where Canadian teams tend to be more sentimental. Like, you know, the Leafs, for example, they've had a lot of opportunities to trade some big pieces on that team, but they've decided to spend huge amounts of cap space to hold on to their big prize players, right? A lot of teams in the States, Tampa, Vegas especially, are ruthless. Like, they literally just look at the numbers on players, and they'll trade you, even if you're Stamkos, who was the captain for a long time, won multiple cups with the Tampa Bay Lightning. Didn't care, right? Like, they did the numbers. His contract was pretty high. They could get more for his money. They traded him and got Gensel. Probably going to be better off long term. So, yeah, it's definitely interesting. I mean, yeah, the States has kind of changed the game with that. Especially, I'd say Vegas is more so even.
Well, the big thing about Vegas too is that Vegas embodies the cutthroat industry anyways, because they have the most money of any franchise other than Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And Toronto simply won't do that because they're subject to their fans. But in Vegas, the fans change every night because no one who's in Vegas goes to watch Vegas. It's just people who are visiting. So they don't really care. Like, let's be real. Vegas does not have a fan base. Well, okay. They have a fan base that exists.
I think it's grown. Like, you know, after they've been grown, so successful, it's definitely grown.
But they just have the ability to do that because their fans, there's not going to be a repercussion if they're cutthroat like that.
Yeah.
But the Canadian teams are so closely scrutinized that they simply can't do that. It's just not possible. But on a separate note, though, Ullmark got a standing ovation after the Senators beat the Bruins. That was his first time back in Boston. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Ullmark right now. He's a good goalie.
I honestly just feel
bad for him that he's on Ottawa.
I want to make a comment on that because I feel like I spoke about this last year. Ottawa Senators had a huge amount of goaltending problems, Korpisalo, Forsberg, and the fan base is just so brutal and demonizing on those two goalies. And yeah, in all fairness, they didn't play very well. But I mean, you're going to wear yourself out when your team hangs you out to dry every shift and you get peppered with 50 shots a night.
Every night.
You're going to start to wear yourself down, and it's going to be hard to stay up on your toes when you have no faith in any defensive play. And I mean, Allmark's a great goaltender, but his numbers aren't that good on Ottawa right now. And I fully would not blame him for that. I just think our defense is not that good. Like, I think it's more of a discipline thing. It comes back to what we talked about a while ago, but they just aren't a structured team, especially the defensive zone, and it just lights up the goalie when they're not not working hard enough.
No, it's true. The Sens don't play with much poise. But on that note, too, you're fully right. The Sens base is just terrible. Last year, they were ripping into Forsberg, calling him not a good player. But it turns out he's playing well now, and they love Forsberg.
And he's actually getting praised this year. I'd say he's been praised more than Allmark, which is a pretty weird turn of events.
So weird.
But he never was bad. That was my larger point, right? You can't blame anything on the goaltender. So Ottawa's got more problems, and they go a lot deeper than just goaltending.
Yeah, but you know what? I got to really stop criticizing some of those guys in the Suns because they're playing pretty well right now. I mean, I don't like Brady Tkachuk, and I never will, but it's hard to criticize a dude who's almost at a point a game, or is above it, actually. And then Stutzel's not playing that bad either. But Stutzel's a princess, let's be real. I love watching the guy play because he's got so much talent, but if you touch that guy, he drops like a stick, not even a fly. The stick hits the ground
the
fly does.
At least he's producing a little bit this year. I mean, I know some people have a theory that Sanderson's still trying to reel in from that Hamonic curse. But yeah, I don't know. The sooner we get rid of him, the better.
Yeah, very much so. And speaking of goaltending, too, Jari just came back from the AHL. He's been recalled to the NHL for Pittsburgh. And he says he's looking to return with a clean slate. He said it's everything. It's something I'll always cherish, being able to pull that jersey over. Not great English, but I wasn't expecting amazing English out of him. But that's kind of beside the point. but he said, I want to come back here and I want to play well. That's my goal. That's what I want to do. I want to help this team as much as possible. Whenever I'm in net, I think giving them a chance to win and helping this team get in a good place. Sorry, I'm not really sure what he was saying there, but that is what he said.
summarizes hockey interviews. Switching gears a little bit here, our special guest Charlie had something to say about the Detroit Lions.
Yeah, no. So I mean, coming back from last year with I think an overall win of maybe one in the season. You know, they kind of had a big resurgence this year with seven victories already and only one loss. So overall, I mean, that's a pretty impressive comeback given the history. So.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I'm not a huge football fan myself, but I watched a couple, like, short, brief, like, kind of 10-minute documentaries on the Lions, actually, not that long ago, and it's definitely a nice story. So they've had the same head coach for a while, and they had actually a handful of seasons that were abysmal, to say the least, like, brutal seasons with a couple wins, like, that stretched for a while, but they had a long rebuild, and they kind of like went through the process, and they've come out pretty strong. So yeah, it's definitely a nice thing to hear.
Absolutely.
Charlie, are you a big Detroit Lions guy?
I'm actually not a big Detroit Lions fan. And similarly with football, you know, I'm not overall a big football enthusiast either. I just find the story really intriguing in general.
He's more of a Dallas Cowboys guy.
That's true.
Oh, is he? Are you actually a Dallas Cowboys guy? Oh, he's nodding his head, folks. Oh my God, I didn't even realize this. He's got his cowboy boots in his backpack. He's just getting ready.
Always.
He's got his satchel too.
Yep.
It's an interesting combination. But Charlie, you know, we've interviewed fantastic athletes in the past, but none as charming as you. And I was wondering if you could speak to your badminton career a little bit. I know you used to play with Kyle. I know you were a prominent player. There's a guy in Ottawa named Sasha Goon who spoke very highly of your fantastic abilities. And since your articulation is manifesting itself in such flavorful manners today, I was wondering if you would bestow upon us such gracious an opportunity to listen to you speak at length.
Yeah, no, so I wouldn't go as far to say as I even pursued a career in badminton in the slightest, but Kyle and I did tickle the occasional tournament back in our high school days, and me personally, no, I always did fairly well. I think I made it to the semis a couple times, but the real hitter was Kyle Sampson. He actually made it to the finals in the interprovincial championship, which was held in Quebec, and I think 2021, and I think he ended up losing to a guy who was about 4 years older than him, which is pretty unfortunate. So overall, I think that, you know, our short-lived badminton career Could have been a little bit worse. So yeah.
I'll talk about that game a bit more. That was actually a really funny game. I had my family was watching me for that game, and yeah, this guy was, I think he was 3 years older than me. I was in grade 9 at the time, and he was in grade 12. And he was about 6'5". So I was not an early grower here. So I you know, picture me at about 5 foot tall versus someone that's literally a foot and a half tall at me. But it was like almost the David and Goliath bit of a match there. My parents could not stop laughing because they're just like, what kind of tournament is this? Like the age categories are a bit more loose in badminton. So I think they do it. Yeah, it's like 3 or 4 year age groupings, which are kind of weird. Same with hockey, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of sports don't do that, especially like track and other things. I mean, yeah, it's definitely an interesting, like 18, especially in an individual sport, I think that's a little bit more questionable just because hockey is like a team sport, so you can kind of like compensate, like not everyone's going to be the bottom age, right? So it kind of works out. But in badminton, it's literally just you versus someone that's
you just
years
get
old.
Taxed essentially.
Yeah, but no, what happened, so badminton's played in 3 sets, and I actually think I won like the first set pretty handily.
Yeah, you did.
Which the guy was like super
not
taken aback by. Yeah. And he beat me by like, you know, 2 points or something. And then, but anyways, yeah, definitely good old times. Charlie was good friends with Brian Yang. He's currently ranked number.
No, well, I mean, I think that was a really interesting point that you're bringing up, Kyle, with the age gap and, you know, the difference in growth spurts. Because I know Sam, our friend here, Sam, had a pretty early growth spurt and a pretty early facial hair
actually,
situation.
No, I was thinking about this today. I think I had a bigger beard at age 12 than I do now.
Oh, no, that's definitely true. But Sam, I was wondering, you know, how was your experience with that overall? Did you find that you were much larger than kids your age when we were in, you know, maybe grade 8? Or?
Well, yeah, I think by the time I was 8 years old, I realized I might be a bit of a GMO. Because things were happening to me that weren't happening to other kids, and
all you know, I can remember
is I was a big kid. I was like 230 pounds at age 12, which is scary.
I just remember people in the stands when Sam was in U12 hockey just shouting Sam the Tank, Sam the Tank, because he would just, there was no hitting in like the early on in hockey, but he was big enough that he just ran over people, and it technically wasn't a hit, but the person was still pretty damaged.
Yeah, that did happen a lot. One thing I do remember is I saw a video of myself playing, and I didn't realize that when I skate by people, they just bump into me and fall. But I didn't even know they were bumping into me. And so there's just a lot of videos I have of me as a kid skating with the puck up the ice, and people are coming trying to like slash me with their stick, but they crash into my leg first or something and fall.
But Sam, like, did you think overall that had a significant impact on maybe your recognition for playing sports later on? Like, do you think your early success contributed to your later success in the final years of high school, or do you think you would have had a similar level of recognition if you had a more typical growth spurt line?
It's difficult to say. I was definitely known as the big kid, but I was never, even when there was contact, a big hitter. I was always more of a playmaker. One thing that being big did, though, is it made me a really big target because I became the person that everyone wanted to hit because I was that big at that age. But that helped me out a lot in some ways because people stopped paying attention to what I was actually doing with the puck and started paying attention to my chest, which meant there was so many more open people on the ice and more space. The only issue is that they got to a point where people actually started getting better than me, and then they could really smoke me and there's nothing I could really do with the puck. And that was difficult. But being big and being like normal height taught me two things. One, I just kind of learned how to take advantage of bigger players because I knew how little players took advantage of me. And honestly, being a normal sized human took a while to get used to. I still don't think I've actually figured out how to play hockey at my height. I still play as though I'm a lot bigger than I am. And sometimes I end up flat on my face, as you both have seen. Sometimes I'm just skating and I just fall. Because I assume that I can lean into someone when I can't. I'm not that big. I'm still 3-4 inches away from them.
Yeah.
So that's been a unique thing.
I mean, a statistic that I think I've referenced before, but I'm pretty sure, like, it's I can't remember the actual percentage, but it's like way more than half of NHL players are born in the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And like almost
70%.
Yeah, like 70% or something, and almost half are born in like January and February.
Yeah.
So that tells you a lot about growth and its impact.
What do you mean born in the first 6 months?
So yeah, so basically like if you're born between January and June, you have 70% of the players in the NHL are born between January and June.
Okay.
30% are born afterwards. So basically the earlier you're born in the year, the quicker you develop as a kid. And so therefore when the draft time comes, you've had more time to physically grow and develop.
Oh, right. Just because of the way that the year's set up.
But what is funny though is if you go to the Hockey Hall of Fame, that doesn't exist at all. If you're very good, it doesn't matter when you're
born. Yeah, no, that's definitely
true. The high-end guys are not impacted by their birth whatsoever.
But you're talking about just in terms of a timeline of having a six-month advantage
like
over...
Yeah, like you had six more months.
Not like an actual biological change.
Well, no, but you had 6 months more to grow as a human being.
Right, right, right.
That is a biological advantage. Absolutely. You were literally born before them. Or I guess it's a historical one. But on the topic of growing, I mean, before this, I was just eating a sort of pizza thing, and I've realized I look pretty harpoonable right now.
Oh,
and it made me think of Randy Santel, the food eating guy. And so this is super random. I'm sorry, guys, but this is a sport that we neglect. Major league eating is a real thing. There's a lot of amateur guys. We watch them a lot. The other day I came downstairs, it was 4 a.m, and Charlie, we call him Chuck, was eating a bowl of cereal and watching Randy Santel and Beard Meets Food eat some wings. Actually, that's not true. I kind of made that up, but you can picture out the scene I'm creating in my head. But it's true. People don't talk about this is an art. And if any of you are devout athletes in Kingston, you'll know that there's a fantastic restaurant called Tommy's, and they have a Tommy's food challenge. And so I bring this up because today we have a water polo game, inner tube water polo game, and we could be eliminated. Now, the idea is that if we get eliminated, we're supposed to go to Tommy's and do this food challenge, which is not going to happen because we have other extracurricular activities to attend to. But my question is, though, do you guys think major league eating should actually be considered a sport?
Well, I you know what? It's actually more popular than you'd think. In a weird way.
And it's also harder than the average human can.
Well, yeah, let's put this into perspective.
I mean, hot dog eating's actually always been fairly big. You know, it's kind of weird. I mean, in Canada, not really, I guess, but in the States, it definitely was fairly large. Mm-hmm. And anyways, this, for context, Sam is bringing this up because he's been training for Tommy's Challenge for some time. He's just working up the courage to do it eventually.
But I also, with that being said, I think there's a certain advantage you have with being a larger individual in eating. Like, for instance, we recently met this guy named James who we're convinced can complete the Tommy Challenge pretty easily. This guy used to be a power lifter, and I think you guys were saying, what, he used to eat 8,000 calories a day?
That's what he told us. I don't even know how he did that.
No, he's being serious, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the thing is, I wish we could show you guys videos on these radio shows.
Because, he's truly a menace.
Huge. Yes. It doesn't even make sense. He was literally, what do you say, 348 pounds? And he cut down to 215 pounds, and he doesn't even look like the same person.
And now he's just what you would classify as an athletic build, and then you would never even recognize him at his peak state. So,
nope.
Yeah, it's insane. But I only bring that up, though, because, you know, Joey Chestnut is an interesting guy. Have you guys heard about Joey Chestnut?
Oh, yeah, of course. It's, you know, the sport's not that small.
No, it's not small at all. Last year he broke the world record, 62 hot dogs in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
62. I don't know if I could do that.
No.
I don't think I could do that.
I don't think I could do that.
How many people could?
No. No, not at all. But maybe we should move back to more recognizable sports. Let's talk about hockey and Ovechkin for a second. We've spoken about this many times. There is a debate that is actually being entertained right now that Ovechkin is a better goal scorer than Wayne Gretzky.
I mean, it. You know what? I don't remember the actual words behind this saying, but there's the saying that goes something along the lines of... you know, there's always going to be someone that tells you like what was or what could have been,
mm-hmm.
and that this is just kind of irrelevant. Like people are always talking about things that like, you know, this time was better, this whatever, like, you know, that's what happened, right? Like, you know, Gretzky had more goals and more games, and you can't really change, you know, it doesn't matter what you say, what happened or what's, you know, the times are different. The fact of the matter is he just had more goals and more games.
Less games, sorry.
And you can't really... like that's just the stats, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't really like the arguments of trying to do these like kind of ratios of like goal scoring eras and trying to do a tabulation of calculating, you know, the reduced goal average because, you know, it was easier to score back then or something. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, like, and I also don't like that too, because I didn't realize this, when people make these comments, they're assuming that these players come with the same like training and equipment, but you can't even do that because, like, would OV have been any good with a wooden stick, rubber skates? Who knows? Would Gretzky have been a god with what we have today? Who knows?
I'll tell you right now, I don't think that one-timer would be ringing off the post so hard with a 200-flex wooden stick.
But... no, I was going to say, Ovechkin has profited the most of the 65-flex stick.
Yeah, probably. But anyways, my point is it's just pointless because, you know, Gretzky's just always going to be the great one, and you can't really challenge that. Although I am impressed with Ovechkin's longevity, he has sustained himself through this season quite well, and I thought he was not looking on the upside after last season. To be completely honest, he didn't play that poorly, but he certainly looked a bit slower compared to his previous years. But this year, maybe he just really wants to retire early, but he's working pretty hard. I saw a video, actually, speaking of working hard, I saw a video of him doing a back check, and he was hustling out there. He was moving like this guy was. He was really hustling, and he stopped a goal with a back check. And I, you know what, that impressed me. Because a lot of time, older players like that don't. They kind of take it back a little bit. They,
especially guys with such a repertoire.
Yeah, let the younger players tire themselves out. But no, Ovi's still back checking and still working hard. So maybe he's got a couple more years left still.
Indeed. Also, just I didn't even know if you guys knew this. This article just got posted right now. Lanny McDonald is no longer going to be chairman of the Hockey Hall of Fame. Do you guys know who that is, Lanny McDonald?
Briefly, yeah.
He's captain of Calgary. He's the only captain to ever lead Calgary to a Stanley Cup championship.
Mm.
He is one of the greatest Canadian hockey players of all time, and he probably has the best personality. This is his last year's chairman. Although, that's kind of irrelevant. That's just kind of sad that he's gone. Although, Shea Weber got inducted to the Hall of Fame this year.
That's interesting.
I could see that coming. I think that the Hall of Fame is a little bit too generous with who they induct, though. I'm not trying to say that Shea Weber isn't good, but I can think of other players who played at the same time as him who have yet to be inducted who are defensemen. I would say might deserve to be in that list, too, and weren't included.
I think, you know what, I actually like Shea Weber quite a bit, but I honestly want to say that the fact that he played in the Canadian market might have almost had an effect on that just because he got way more recognition.
Well, I mean, Canada does actually run the Hockey Hall of Fame. The NHL doesn't really have much
oversight.
It's
in Toronto, yeah.
We dictate who goes where.
I'm not disappointed with that choice. I thought he was a fantastic player. I mean, he was unbelievable on Montreal for a couple of years there, and he was a good, just a good guy, a good overall player. So
I think that's a lot of the reason why he got inducted to the Hall of Fame, because his stats are impressive, but they're not phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of all the Hall of Famers I can think of, he has some of the lower stats, for sure.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, and he got plagued with injuries. I mean, I felt bad that he kind of retired that way. Yeah. It's too bad.
But although I'd say he could be a top 10 captain all time in terms of leadership.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably.
That, you know what? That is what Montreal needs right now desperately, is like a reincarnation of Shea Weber, which, you know, that doesn't come around so often. So
no.
They're looking for a new someone to fill his shoes. It's a pretty difficult task.
But there were rumors that Jason Spezza might get inducted to the Hall of Fame after, in a few years. What, do you think he will? I don't know if he would. He's good, maybe. But did he really do that much in Ottawa?
You know, Spezza was pretty darn big for a while.
But wasn't Alfie bigger? Alfie's not in the convo.
Yeah, I don't know. The Hall of Fame's always got some weird stuff going on. And Ottawa's also kind of got some random, Chris Neal's a great player. We retired his jersey, which was, I thought was nice.
Yeah, that was a more of a gesture for his loyalty to the team, though.
I think that, yeah, too. That was kind of, I didn't think that was random, but it was, retiring a jersey used to be, pretty darn serious. Gretzky or something, these huge names got retired. But anyways, I'll move to one more thing. I mean, I usually do kind of, we did an earlier prediction on NHL. We've had a little, things settle a little bit now, and with our last couple minutes here, we'll just do
to talk about Winnipeg.
True. Yeah. Speaking on that, we'll just do a brief we don't have that much time to go through all the rankings, but we'll just say, who's the top three from East and West, or, kind of brief, something like that.
Well, yeah. So Winnipeg's number one in the league, first of all. They are the only team since 2005 to go the first 15 games of the season without losing a single game on the road. They've won 6 away. They've lost 1 at home, 8 at home. But they have the best record in the first 15 games of a season since 2005, since the lockout, which is insane. So they're the head of
Western Division, yeah.
The Western Division, and what's completely forget. What conference are they in again? They're in the Central. They're in the Central.
One per entire division.
Okay, way. Winnipeg's top of the Western Conference. They're in the Central. LA is top of the Pacific. 21 points, 16 games played, 9 wins, 4 losses, 3 OT losses. That's not bad, but honestly, Vegas is better than them. Vegas has played 14 games and won 9 games.
Yeah.
And not, like, yeah, they, I mean, I they're 1 point that, behind. Yeah. I think Vegas is going to finish in the top of the Pacific. Vancouver's third right now. Actually, they're doing pretty good, too. Yeah. 13 games, 17 points. Okay, actually, that's not great.
But after last night, they got blown up by the Oilers, 7-2.
Yeah, the Oilers' resurgence is crazy right now. This is the thing. I swear the Oilers always do this.
They just
start terribly, and then they blow up. They blow up. But then the Atlantic, no surprise. Florida's at the top. Boston and Toronto are kicking around, but Boston's really only there because they played more games. They're at 500. They're 16-16. And then the Metropolitan, New Jersey's there. They're going to get surpassed by Carolina, though. Yeah. Washington's doing good, too, which is kind of random.
Washington's doing pretty good.
They don't really have
New York. Players, but New York's been decent, and I think they're definitely still up there.
You know what? If New York had played one more game, they would be in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
They're just 1 point.
Yeah. I mean, my only criticism on that maybe is I do agree with Winnipeg being highly ranked, but
they're going to lose at some point.
I just don't actually have that much confidence in their playoff hockey.
No, Sam. I think they're a great season team, but not a playoff team.
If anyone watched the playoffs from last year and Winnipeg's games against the Avalanche, man, like, they got absolutely destroyed. Like, it was demoralizing. Like, I'm sure they came back with a vengeance this year because of that, but that was a very decisive first round exit. Like, they just got absolutely walked all over every game.
It was tough to watch.
But, that tends to happen when you have Hellebuck putting out, you know, shutout after shutout. You're going to win some games here.
Yeah.
He's been playing unreal. I mean, he's the only goaltender in the league that's, like, always consistent. Like, he just seems to almost never have a bad game. Like, him and, like, Shesterkin maybe, but Shesterkin had a pretty bad game the other night. I mean, yeah, like, those two goaltenders are in, like, a different league, essentially. Like, Hellebuck, year after year, remains insanely consistent. So yeah, unbelievable. I would have my rankings pretty similar. I think the Kings are actually totally inflated. They've had some really bad games and they're kind of they're a decent regular season team, but
they're 500. They're not going to stay here.
Yeah. I don't really see the longevity in that. I think there'll be some stuff moving around. Honestly, the Avalanche haven't been that bad, but they
haven't been that good, though. That's the other
thing. Their goaltending is so worrying that they're not going to be a contender because of that one.
And I don't think McKinnon is good enough to compensate for bad goaltending. Whereas McDavid can actually put up multiple goals if he has to. McKinnon can, but not consistently.
But, you know, the Avalanche have been plagued with injuries. There's so many injuries on the Avalanche right now. It's brutal. I spoke about Arturi Laikkanen not that long ago. He came back. He's played 3 games for the Avalanche since returning after two years, essentially, for a shoulder surgery. And he's got 4 points in 3 games. So he's sitting pretty nice in that first line. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of promise for them. But, yeah, again, I just think the goaltending's too big to kind of overcome like that.
Yeah.
My rankings for the Western Conference are virtually the same. I think I'm not actually that sold on Vancouver.
I think Vancouver's the most overhyped and overinflated team. Like, they're not even good.
Quinn Hughes has been playing well. He's been playing well.
He's a one-man show. A one-man show at the point.
Yeah, we spoke about Elias Pettersson being probably injured, pretty likely. Mm-hmm. So that's been a pretty big hit, and they don't have Demko right now either. So
when's Demko supposed to be back again? Isn't it in December?
He's still on long-term, so...
Okay, maybe it's not even December.
It might be a bit, yeah.
That's been a talk, so Demko hasn't even really played for Vancouver in the last 2 years.
He's made of glass.
He's made of glass.
It's just, you can't play like that, yeah. It's just bad knees is shattered, everything shatters.
I don't know, it's worse being made of sand or glass.
But yeah, no, I mean, I think my rankings are pretty similar, essentially. I think that third spot in the Western Division is a bit, let's say, up for grabs right now.
Yeah,
it is. And then on the Eastern side, I definitely think Carolina, New Jersey's been pretty good.
I say New Jersey has some credit.
Mike in New Jersey.
The Hughes brothers are good together. That's a good combo.
And I mean New York's just always gonna be there. And then Carolina, like those three. Panthers though. Panthers are probably up there. I'm gonna say Panthers squeeze out New Jersey for the top three there. So Panthers top and then probably New York. And this is for my regular season predictions. I don't think these guys, this is gonna be the podium essentially, but
I think Panthers are gonna be on the podium for sure. I just don't know if they'll fit in. They have the ability to fluctuate quite a bit in the season.
Yeah, Panthers, New York, and then probably Carolina, I'd say the strongest looking teams as where we stand right now.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Chuck, what are your thoughts?
Totally agree.
Totally agree. Well, who's your favorite team in the NHL? We didn't even ask you that.
Not being a big hockey guy, I think I'm going to have to go with the home team here of the Ottawa Senators, but I know that that's quite a controversial topic right now. So,
this is an Ottawa-heavy podcast.
Very Ottawa-heavy.
Well, we'll hope that the Senators turn it around a little bit for Charlie here. That basically wraps it up for our episode today. And then, again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope to see you next week.
Love playing board games? Are you looking for a place on campus to make friends in a relaxed environment? Look no further than Queen's Board Game Club. Join us for weekly Thursday game nights on campus and follow our Instagram at Queen's Board Game Club for more details.
Help CFRC serve our community listeners. Have your voice heard and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smokes Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
We also occasionally do interviews.